So for this morning's Dhamma talk, it's always really difficult for a monk like me because I give so many talks. Every day over the last year I think I've given at least one talk a day, sometimes two. Sometimes you have a day off, but if I have a day off I'm pretty sure I talk in my sleep. You just get used to it. And worse, every time you give a talk it's always recorded. So it's very hard to actually to get something new. And I don't know why this topic came up just as I was walking in here, as I thought, what should I talk about today? But I'm going to talk about a topic I very rarely talk about. And a topic which is really interesting for many of you. Psychic powers. And you say, wow, yeah, a lot. Thank you so much. Because sometimes it's part of the path, it happens, but sometimes, you know, read about it in the suttas, but sometimes that, you know, monks don't like to talk about that, and there's a good reason for that, and because it is a dangerous area in some aspects. Other parts of it is actually very useful, and it's just something which, you know, happens from time to time. And already, sort of, by talking about all this incredible healings which happens in meditation, and that's, you know, miraculous. And the trouble with being a Buddhist monk is that, you know, just no one let take that for granted. But I often sort of thought, if I was a Christian, you know, and you did all these sorts of things, then you could become a saint by now. There'd be Saint Brahm's school and Saint Brahm's church, and most of you would be the same. If you get into a jhana, which many lay people do. And as soon as you get into a jhana, that, you know, in Christianity, that's called union with God. You'll be another saint. And you'll be Saint Ananda's. You'll be Saint Vicky's school. You get Saint Suwadee's hospital. Because, you know, these are very powerful experiences, but they're not that difficult to attain. You know, it happens to people. And with those powerful states of mind, I think sometimes you can experience that there is a huge amount of energy and potential there. And sometimes when your mind really gets still, it really gets incredible power. And this is the teaching which is important to know all the way through your life, is in all aspects of your life, is mindfulness. People talk a lot about mindfulness, but I haven't heard many other monks talk about the different intensities of mindfulness. The fact that sometimes your mindfulness is there, but it's not very powerful. It hasn't got much energy. It's like riding a bicycle. Yeah, you've got a vehicle, mindfulness, but it's not that powerful. And sometimes in meditation, your mindfulness gets so strong, it's like you've got a Ferrari. And you can really put your foot down. You can just speed off really fast. And, you know, this is the power which you can feel with mindfulness. But the most important thing to develop that mindfulness, like everything else, is stillness. And I mentioned this, and this is so important, that stillness is the cause for mindfulness. You can't just say, I'm going to be mindful, and use your willpower and decision. Right, I'm going to be mindful today. I'm going to watch every movement of my body, every sort of breath, and when I eat, I'm going to be very mindful. Sometimes you try to do that, but you get tired and you wander off. You can't maintain it. It's not the right way to develop mindfulness. But you find that when you get very peaceful and very still, the mindfulness becomes natural. It becomes so aware of what you're doing. That's one of the reasons why that when you do walking meditation, don't just force the mind to walk, the body to walk slowly. Walk naturally. But it does happen that as you get more and more still, as the mindfulness gets stronger, there's so many things to be aware of that basically that this, you can't go fast. You know, there's too many things happening. So you quite naturally go really, really slowly because, wow, to observe all these things, I just cannot go fast. Now the walking becomes calm and quiet just by itself. So it is, you can see the stillness creates more mindfulness, the mindfulness creates more power, creates more stillness. It's a natural process. And it's why that during a retreat like this, coming to this stage of the retreat, you should already actually have mindfulness far more awake than you usually are. And this also reminds you that whatever you do in your life, you know, to be competitive, you know, to get on in the world, you have to be very alert. And that degree of alertness and awareness is built up through meditation. You become better at studies. If you're a student, you become more aware. You can pick up more what the lecturer says. You can read a book and more gets absorbed. You can record it far easier. If you are problem solving, you know, trying to balance books in an accountant, or trying to work out the best strategy for marketing a product in business, or figuring out contracts and being able to write it in such a way that, you know, everyone is happy. Those sorts of skills, you mean, have to be very precise and very alert, which is one of the reasons why that if you practice mindfulness and it gets very, very strong, you become very, very competent, even if you're a doctor. You know, you have all those symptoms in front of you, some which you're physically conscious of, you can see and you can hear from them, but others you can just sense. And when you get very, very mindful, you can pick up things which other people can't. And so with very, very strong mindfulness, you actually become very powerful. And that becomes part of the way to develop psychic powers. And sometimes I think it's psychic, it's strange, it's weird, it's supernatural. It's not really supernatural, it's just nature, which many people don't explore. The fact that you are incredibly mindful, you pick up things, what another person is telling you. Tones of the voice, smells from the body, body language, you can pick up so much that people think, wow, you're reading my mind, how did you know that? And the answer is, you told me. Because you're just sensitive, and highly sensitive, you can pick things up. And this is interesting for you to experience. When the meditation really starts getting strong, you feel you've got energy, you feel you've got power, and these things come naturally. But if you want to develop these things, which many people do, that is because of ego and pride. You know, you want to be like a superpower, superman, superwoman, and be able to fly through the air, not because, you know, it's something which might be helpful, just because it's cool and it's weird and it's something you just want to show off. But those sorts of powers, if you do put any sort of ego in there, once there is a self, there is a controlling, and that's where you lose all those powers. It's quite fortunate. It's just the way these things have actually work. It's like the laws of physics, that if you start to get attached, own powers, be proud of those powers which have developed, keep showing them off to people, then you'll lose them. You cannot maintain them. Once the ego, the sense of self gets involved, yeah, I can read minds, I can float through the air, I can do this. When you begin to think this is your personal attainment, you tend to control. When you tend to control, you weaken that power of the mind. You're not letting go anymore. You're just disturbing it. And all those natural effects just disappear. But one of the most important psychic powers, according to the Buddha, is one which I actually encourage. And that is being able to remember your past lives. And the reason I do this is because as a monk, I get quite frustrated, especially when I go and give a talk to scientists. And there's some universities. And I just cannot get my head around the fact that people don't accept reincarnation or rebirth. Sometimes people say, what's the difference between reincarnation and rebirth? It's just a couple of scholars make a very fine distinction. But we're not talking to scholars here. The only distinction, reincarnation is a soul gets reborn. Rebirth is a stream of consciousness gets reborn. What's the difference? Maybe if you're a very learned party scholar, you may know the difference, but for every Tom, Dick and Harry, it doesn't really matter at all. So sometimes I say reincarnation, sometimes I say rebirth. Basically, people understand the same thing. But it's amazing just how many people in today's world are not accepting of things like reincarnation and rebirth, even some monks. And it's incredible what you're doing as a monk if this obvious teaching you don't accept. The evidence is there, you know, and if anybody cares to actually be logical and actually have their ideas evidence-based, you don't have to need to go further than Ian Stevenson's work. This guy who was, researching cases of people who have spontaneous memories of past lives, little kids who come up and say, you know, yeah, you know, you're not my real mummy. My real mummy lives somewhere else. And, you know, they go and check up on it. And this research which he did was making sure that these kids could not have got their evidence from any other source whatsoever. And, of course, there's many, many people who claim to be reborn, and it was just, you know, someone in the next village or in the next house. Cases like that, they had to just push aside. You know, they couldn't use those as evidence. But with all the hundreds of thousands of cases referred to these researchers, there was always a few who had clear memories of a previous life, and there's no way they could have got that information from any other source whatsoever. And so it's those cases which he focused on and actually checked them out to see whether they were real or not. And you know, there's enough of them proved to be real. There's very, very hard evidence. And that evidence, one of our friends, I don't know if you know Michael Carr, he managed to go and see Ian Stevenson before he passed away and had dinner with him. And we got the set of his books, which he presented to the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Have you got, is it in our library or is it in the BSWA library? Mahinda, is it in the BSWA library? That's the Ian Stevenson's books. Yeah, there. No, signed by him for the BSWA. But, you know, over dinner, he was telling Michael that, you know, he's just so, so disappointed. Because, you know, he was a top researcher. And he said if that was any other field other than reincarnation, you know, he'd have probably got some prizes. But because his community refused to even accept the possibility that these things exist, he was just sidelined as some crackpot scientist. Whereas the research is extremely rigorous. Professor, yeah, Professor University of Virginia. A professor of, I think, psychiatry. You know, he had huge amounts of research done before he started this one. And he was very, very well respected. And so this particular one, he lost respect, not because of his methodology, because no one wanted to accept this particular truth. The evidence is there. And of course, we always have the evidence from near-death experiences as well. And actually, one of his cases, Ian Stevenson's cases, I met this boy in Chiswick in London when I gave a talk at the Sri Lankan temple. You know, he came and introduced himself to me. And this is seven or 16 cases in his first most popular book by Ian Stevenson. And this little kid came up to me and I talked to him about, you know, his recollections. And what really struck me was not his recollections, but how he said to me, he was about 16 or 17 at the time when I met him, it was about 30 years ago. And he said, that was the worst thing I ever did, telling people about my past lives. That I had a hell of a childhood. You know, because it was published, all my friends at school heard about it. And you know what happens at school? You get teased and bullied. Anything which is slightly out of the ordinary, your friends, so-called friends at school, especially in boys, they tease you, bully you. And he said, had a terrible time at school. And when I heard that, I said, look, these people who claim these lives, they claim it at their peril. They don't have fun with it. Except for one lady. You know, she lives in Perth. I won't say who she is. Her story of her past life memories was actually quite amusing because it was in a village in northeast Thailand. And when she was born and could speak, she had very clear memory of being in a previous life, being the mother of the present school headmaster. And her recollections, you know, things which no one else could have known, were so accurate and so convincing, so many of them. The whole village, they accepted in her previous life, now she was in this village, and her son was now the current headmaster of the village school. which was all very well until she went to that school. And you know, this was in Thailand, like maybe Singapore, Malaysia. In even today, you know, when the teacher comes into the school, everybody stands up, especially the principal. So when her first day at school, the principal came into the assembly to welcome everybody, all the children stood up except for her, this little 5-6-year-old girl. I'm not standing up for my son. He should stand up for me. The point was, the headmaster knew that was his mother, so he couldn't do anything. And whenever she got into trouble, you know, this was some years ago, you know, they would use the cane if anybody misbehaved. But this girl, you know, when she was sent to the principal's office for misbehaving, she walked out almost straight away, because the principal just couldn't touch her. Honestly, how can you cane your mother? So she said she had a wonderful time at school, never learnt anything, because she had the principal under her thumb. Son, you know, don't tell your daughter, your mum, what to do. This is 6-year-old telling this 40-year-old. But that was a funny story. It does complicate things enormously, you know, when you sort of remember past lives. But for these days, there's so many people reject it. And it does change the way that people regard Buddhism and other things in the world. It's almost like a mission of mine to try and get as many people to recall their past lives as possible. Because it's going to change the world. It's going to change, especially your idea of what Buddhism is and Dharma. It's going to make it real fuller. And in fact, if ever you read the teachings of the Buddha, you know, he says this is the first crack in the egg when a chick gets born. It's one of his similes of, you know, insight, enlightenment. You know, he says, you know, when sort of a chick is being hatched, you have the first little crack in the egg and then a bigger crack, and then the egg totally cracks open and the newborn chick comes out. And that was the arahat. He said the first crack in the egg is actually remembering your past lives. And the second crack in the egg is understanding the law of karma. And basically you can't understand the law of karma if you don't understand rebirth. Because, you know, a lot of times people say, why is it that bad people seem to have good lives and good people tend to suffer? If you just look at this narrow one life, it doesn't make any sense. It's not logical, not reasonable. You have to look at the bigger picture of many lives to understand why these things happen to people. And it's important things to understand, because it's why things happen to you. I did mention to you this one of our members who recently, through regression, recalled his past life. And it turned out to be totally accurate, and it really blew his mind to know that it was actually real. And that was really him. And as a result of that, you know, he became a real Buddhist. You know, he was on the edge, come to Dhammaloka, but now he takes 5 precepts. He gave up alcohol, as I mentioned the other day. He always liked a bit of wine or a beer every now and again. But it's interesting, the consequence of him recording a past life and knowing, yes, that was me, without any doubt at all, was that the importance of the 5 precepts became really powerful. Monks, we can teach you the 5 precepts, we can encourage you the 5 precepts, we can say if you keep the 5 precepts, you can become a member of our Buddhist society and come on these retreats. There's all sorts of incentives we put in there to try and get people to keep 5 precepts. But even so, it's not that important as if you really understand why. And that's what this guy did. He saw a reason why in a way which, you know, no one can ever teach you. You have to experience that. And he did when he got his past life memories. So the results of understanding your past lives or catching them is really powerful. Which is why I encourage it. So how do you do it? And of course, this is just one of the things which happens, and one of the psychic powers which happens when you develop your mind. So you're meditating, just exactly everything which I've told you so far, letting go, because just like these jhanas, when you talk psychic powers, people get interested, yeah, I want one of those. Yeah, can I please, they're on offer, so I want one. And of course, if you really, really, really want one, you have to not want them, and then you get them. As you know by now, and this is not some sort of weird gobbledygook gobbledygook Zen speak. This is just understanding just how these things develop. You have to let go, be very peaceful, be very still. And then the mindfulness gets strong. Part of the mindfulness getting strong is the body vanishes, it's just focused in the mind. You get these incredible, beautiful lights. That's a sign that you've got very strong mindfulness. It feels that way, you've got power. And at this point, I'm just going to go into the path of practice a little bit, because when people do get those lights, a lot of times there are two problems come up. The two main obstacles. Now, this is actually from the Upakalesa Sutta, which is there in the Majjhima Nikaya taught by the Buddha. But, you know, I just focus on the two big problems which happens, you know, to people with nimittas. And that is fear and excitement. And the fear comes up again because these are huge experiences. I mean, the biggest things in your life. And you are really afraid. Number one, can I handle this? Because this is huge spiritual power. It is like being put at the wheel of a Ferrari. You know, can you drive such a thing? It's just really big and powerful. Or, like I was just showing a few minutes ago, when I was in Hong Kong, you know, there's got many disciples in Cathay Pacific. I've been teaching there for years. And they decided to give me a treat this time, to take me into the areas where they train people. And even took me into flight simulator. And they're there sitting at the controls of a 777, which is illegal, because you're not supposed to have non-authorized people training how to fly jets. You know why. But you know, I'm not going to blow up anything. I'm not a terrorist. I'm the last person who would do that. But, you know, they had a... I just showed him the photograph that's on the internet there, of me at the controls of a 777. Really cool. Captain Brahm, they called it. But, you know, there's incredibly powerful machines. Can you handle it? And this is what sometimes happens when you get these incredibly powerful mind states. You get fear. And it's mostly fear of losing control. And if you haven't done letting go enough when you get to these stages, you can't let go and allow these things just to be. It's one of these stupid things of a human being. We always want to control things. Even, I don't know, when you're just working in the kitchen, how many of you may have already given some suggestions, you know, to Bianca on how to run the kitchen. How they should chop the vegetables, how you should do this. Because what's it got to do with you? You know, you're just eating. Just take it easy, it's good enough. But whenever we get involved in something, we always tend to want to control it. And we're just afraid to let things be. And it is a sense of fear. Which is one of the reasons why I gave this little simile many, many times. The sort of confidence and letting go necessary to get into these jhanas. Even like getting the nimitta to be strong. It's like, very similar to, you're driving along the freeway in very busy traffic, 110 kilometers an hour, and I'm sitting next to you in the passenger seat. And you're driving in busy traffic, and I turn around to you and say, okay, take your hand off the steering wheel. Take your hand off. Could you do that? Would you do that in the busy traffic? Because you'd be, no, I can't do that, we'll crash. Come on, take your hand off the steering wheel. No. Take your hand off the steering wheel. Take your foot off the pedal. See what happens. Now, this is only a simile. Don't do that in the real world. Because sometimes, you know, I've got to be really careful as a monk, because sometimes people have so much faith in me, or faith in monks, their faith is far in excess of their common sense. And the story behind this, you know, there are some anecdotes in life you just cannot make up. And the most funniest jokes are actually things which really happened. And this was apparently some nuns in England. They were being driven, I think, to the airport. And the senior nun in the passenger seat, and one of these drivers who had total faith in the nuns. And the nun in the passenger seat was giving directions. So she told the driver, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And that's what she did. Straight ahead, right over the hump in the middle. So that's when someone says to me, now which way? I said, straight ahead of the lights, once they're green. You've got to be very careful. Otherwise, they go straight through. They say, well, you told me to. I've got faith in you. You've got psychic powers. You're enlightened everything. Wow. So don't let your faith exceed your common sense. So anyway, so there is that fear there. And this is the way to imagine that. And there was one lady in the last retreat, no, sometime recently. I think it was the January retreat, November retreat. Anyway, they said they had a dream. And at the dream, it was very similar to what I was telling her to do with her limiters, just to really let go. In her dream, she was in a car, driving really fast, and I was in the passenger seat next to her. And in her car, going really fast, we came to a cliff. And, you know, she wanted to put on the brakes. And apparently I told her, no, just don't put on the brakes. Actually, take your feet off all the pedals. Take your hand off the steering wheel. And as she came to the edge of the cliff, she saw it was really steep. And right down on the bottom of the cliff, there was a very sharp right turn. And apparently she looked at me and said, just relax, let go. And she was so proud of herself because she did. And she's in this car, and it's in a dream, hurtling down to her death at the bottom of this cliff. And as apparently we hit the bottom of the ground, the car automatically, all by itself, turned right and just went along the road, perfectly safe. And he said, wow, you see, it does work. At least in dreams, anyway. She was very proud of that dream. But that is a good indication of what you have to do to develop the limiters. You really have to let go of all your fear. And all the fear is letting go of control. And that's sometimes why that you have a little bit of faith is important. To have that confidence and trust that I know what I'm talking about. That's why it's great that you've known me for many years. And everything I've told you so far works. So why not try this as well? And if you have any doubts, look in the sutras. You see Upaklesa Sutta. The fear is one of the big things. And the simile the Buddha gave for fear in the Upaklesa Sutta is one of his best ones. He said it's just like you're walking down a path having a great time. And murderers jump out at you from behind the bushes. You get afraid. Ah! Because that's what it feels like, that people are taking away, murdering your sense of self. You're disappearing. You're vanishing. Not killing your body, but killing your idea of who you think you are. Your delusion of self. That's being taken away from you. And that is really scary. It's also the same sort of fear, but magnified, which I mentioned before. And this is a common fear, which you should understand. All the way through the meditation, it's a fear of the prisoner about to be released from jail. You think, what on earth is a prisoner afraid for? They're going to be free. They can be able to go wherever they like, eat whatever they like, and do all those things which are prohibited in jail. But, prisoners who've been in jail for a long time, they'd actually prefer not to be free because they got used to prison. That's one of the other fears which come up at these stages. You're going into powerful states and places you haven't been before, so it does need a bit of confidence. And that is why I talk about those states, to make you know what you're doing, where it is, and how it all fits in to the scheme of Buddhist meditation and enlightenment. So eventually you should become quite at least used to it and know it's safe and know it's actually very wonderful. And you have a great, great time. So that's why I talk all these things, to give you that confidence. It's okay. You don't need to be afraid. And of course, the other thing is excitement. Because you are going to huge states of mind. It's like winning the lottery. It's like all those dreams you ever had, they're right there in front of you. And my goodness, it is really powerful. Every time I say this, I get the goosebumps, because when you get into the first jhana, the first time, No, you realize that you are experiencing exactly the same mind. No difference, not one iota of difference, the Buddha experienced under the Bodhi tree. The body vanished, but the mind is exactly the same quality. No difference. So if you ever get a first jhana, now you know how the Buddha felt. 100%. When I realize, that just blows you away. And that's one of the reasons why I tell people these days, yeah, I've been on those pilgrimages to India. It's really tiring, it's dirty, and these days it's really noisy. They're getting so popular. It's hard to do some meditation in a place like Bodh Gaya. There's always so much stuff going on. So I tell people, if you really want to go and visit the four holy places of Buddhism, you don't have to go to India. The four holy places of India are first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and fourth jhana. Those are the holy places of Buddhism, not physical places, places in the mind, because these are the places the Buddha lived. His body was in Rajagaha, the vulture's peak. His body was in the bamboo grove and in Sarvati. But where he lived most of the time was in the jhanas. So if ever you get one of these states, when you come out after us, remember, you've just been visiting where the Buddha lived. And you know what it feels like to be a Buddha. Only temporary, but that is enough to really, really start to get your faith, inspiration and energy just flying way into the stratosphere. Powerful. But because these are such incredible states, of course you get excited. It's always impossible not to. It's a nimitta, it's a powerful one. At last, woohoo! And so many people, me included, when you first get these states or get close to them rather, you blow it time and time again. It's what I call the wow response. There's this beautiful state coming, wow! And then it just disappears again. I don't know if you remember the children's game Snakes and Ladders. Remember Snakes and Ladders? You sort of go on this board game, you throw this dice, and then, you know, if you land on the bottom of a ladder, you go straight up. If you land on the mouth of the snake, you go down. And that board game, just when you get to the almost to the finish, there's lots of snakes, and you go way, way down. And that's what it's like, you know, when you almost, you know, got to the end, you got to the jhana, you're on the edge there, you go, wow, you know, you land on the snake, you go way back to the beginning again. That really sucks. You're so close, and just one wow, and you're back to the beginning almost. But that's one of the reasons why you tell people this. You can expect this to happen because these are powerful states. And you can feel their intensity, their power. This is huge. Which is, be aware of the fear and the excitement. Yeah, you'll do it a few times. Then after a few times, you learn. You know, you learn maybe from trial and error not to be so afraid and not to be excited. Now, there is one also skillful means about, you know, those sorts of powerful states of mind, how to handle them. And if you get, say, excited many times and you keep blowing it, what to do is what I call the programming of mindfulness. It's another way to overcome obstacles in meditation, but the programming mindfulness really helps in the more refined obstacles, like the fear and excitement which comes when things really start to happen. And what that programming mindfulness is that you're meditating, you sit down, cross your legs, get yourselves comfortable. And just, you know, once you're really settled in, maybe 3 or 4 minutes, then you tell your mind, you know, silently, just the thought, when I get to that stage, I will not be afraid. When I get to that stage, I will not be afraid. When I get to that stage, I will not be afraid. In your own words, I said that stage, you mean that nimitta stage, or when the nimitta gets big, whatever it is a problem for you, in your own words, in your own language even, always 3 times, because the 3 times reinforces it. And pay as much attention as you can Don't just say it and just be thinking of something else. Really pay full attention to what you're saying, because you're giving yourself instructions. You're programming your mindfulness. Your mindfulness. And the more attention you give it, the more it works. And after saying it to yourself 3 times, you totally forget it. You know, the antivirus is in the machine. And it's incredible how well that works. You know, you're meditating here and this incredible, powerful nimitta comes out, you start getting excited. Suddenly it kicks into the mind. No, I won't get excited. Subverbal, you don't need to do anything, it happens by itself. It's like an antivirus. So programming your mindfulness, especially for problems which arise at the deeper stages of meditation, really, really is very helpful. It works the best way. And so, you know, you're just about to get sort of not afraid, but I'm not excited, but afraid. You get to a stage where I don't think I can handle this. I don't want to go any further. And if that happens, program mindfulness, when I get to this stage, I will not be afraid. I will not be afraid. I will not be afraid. And it happens. The fear just vanishes. Because you put that suggestion into your mind. And now it kicks in. And when that occurs, it means you do get very powerful and very still. And, you know, you have the courage to handle it. And it's not that hard. One thing is extremely safe. It's the safest you'll ever be. And I did mention about those monks, one monk who was burnt alive and just nothing, no flames affected him. That monk, you know, who had the lights coming out of his eyes and who was in the jungles in Java and was underwater. There's many stories like that. I mention those stories to tell you, you are safe. Probably more safe than any other time in your life. I don't understand why people can't get burnt. Why, you know, that they obviously understand why they don't drown, because they don't need oxygen. But certainly you are perfectly safe. So please don't be afraid when you let go. And so you get in these incredible stages of meditation. And in order to get your past lives, once you're in those stages, such a simple technique. And I don't know where I got this one from, but you say to yourself, what is my earliest memory? All you're doing is giving that little nudge to your mind, only once. Now go look for early memories. And if you are in a state which is powerful and still enough for this to work, those memories will come up straight away. You don't have to wait and repeat it. Nothing's happening. If it's going to happen, it happens immediately. Now, I have to be careful because I have rules. And especially now, these days, you know, because of bhikkhunis and I have to be really careful because there's some people out to get me. If I make any little mistake in my Vinaya, they will, wah-da-bum, see, he's a bad monk. So please excuse me if I have to be almost hyper-vigilant, but I cannot tell you about previous lives. But I have a loophole. And I always exploit loopholes. The loophole is, no, I can't tell you about previous life, but I can tell you about early life. It's the same process, but you know, it doesn't get me into trouble. And it was the time when I first did this, many, many years ago. You know, I don't know why, where this came from. But then you're sitting there, it's actually in the hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, many, many years ago, just really nice meditation, really deep. And when you come out afterwards, you've just got so much energy. You can feel you've got power. And you say, what's my earliest memory? And straight away, a smell came into my nose. It wasn't a smell which was in the hall. It was a smell which no one else could be able to perceive. It was from my past. And immediately, that smell came into my nose. I recognized it. It was the smell of my baby's pram. That little four-wheeled cart they would put babies in those days to wheel them back and forth. I think they call them strollers now, is it? But anyway, this is where you're on the back. Was it still called pram? Okay. Oh, pram, anyway. My baby's pram. And as soon as I recognized it was the smell, my baby's pram, you were back there. just as aware as you are right now listening to me. You know, you're a baby. You can feel your baby's body. And interesting thing, you could look around and, you know, just a little bit of will. You know, not strong-willed, I must do this. It's just, as soon as you think, let's have a look at the pram, you could see the colours. It's just black and white, no other colours in there. And you can, one of the things I recognised was my favourite toy, you know, when I was just born, which was a porcelain pig. You know, it was upright, like a standing upright, and it had little, I think, beans inside of it, so you could rattle it. And I remember my mother would walk it. And I would love that little pig. I would always gurgle and laugh every time. And there you were, looking at your first toy when you first came into this world, being able to look around and experience your pram and your toy. And it was a light blue, just like the colours of the Singapore Airlines, what's it called, blankets which you're wearing. So, you know, this was really clear memory. You were back there. And part of that memory was you had absolutely no doubt at all, which was another strange part of this, that was you. Not, you know, is this a memory? Is this not a memory? Is this my past? Or this is just an imaginary sort of fantasy? That sort of doubt that was totally absent. You knew it was you. And you could stay there as long as you like. You came out afterwards and, wow, that was really weird. And of course, you don't go around telling too many people about these things because, you know, a lot of times people think you might be crazy. It's all right telling these things if you're a monk because people assume you're crazy. But if you're a lay person, you've got to be careful. And so anyway, I told a couple of people, and I remember telling this gynecologist, and he was very taken with this because he said, you know, the interesting thing about your recollection is that I know, as a gynecologist, that at that stage of your life, you know, the first weeks of your life, the most dominant sense is your smell. You know, your visual part of your brain hasn't developed yet, neither is your audio part. You know, your sense is the first sense to really develop as a baby. And I said, wow, that's actually exactly right, because I could remember that. Now, you'd recognize your mother, you'd recognize even your toys, you'd recognize your pram by its smell, not by what it looked like. And, you know, these days the smell is not really developed. We don't notice the smell very much, but in the first weeks of your life, smell is your one major sense which you recognize the world for. So it's an amazing little sort of insight which was from an early experience, which was confirmed, which I never expected. And of course, I'm always a bit cheeky and like telling jokes. And because I know how important that is for a young kid, if ever you have a baby, please, for goodness sake, never change your perfume. Because if you change your perfume, your baby will not know who the hell you are. They won't be able to recognize you because it's the smell. Is what you recognize, you know, your mother and father by. And anyway, just that was a really nice experience. But if you want to go back earlier, that's all you say. Earlier, please. Maybe it's because I was born in England, I'm supposed to be polite. So even to my mind, I say earlier, please. Maybe if you were born in the United States, you say earlier or else. I don't know. And if your mind is powerful, it does it. It just goes earlier back. Now, this is where I have to leave personal experiences and I tell other people's experiences, you know, just to get out of breaking any rules. And it's quite common that people actually get experiences of in your mother's womb. You know, what it's actually like to be a fetus. And straight away, when you know what it's like to be a fetus in a womb, then the argument about, you know, do fetuses feel abortion, is that right or wrong? Then you can actually have some much better ideas about when it is wrong and when it is right, because you've got personal experience of what it's like to be a fetus in a womb. And when you've developed enough to actually to be able to feel pleasure and pain or whatever, so you can feel that. But I remember this one lady, I won't say who she is because she's well known in the Perth community. She was doing this, and she's got a very pure mind and very easy to get into deep meditation. She got her early life memory, and now she was a little baby being breastfed by her mother. And then she looked up at her mother, and she was shocked. She came to see me immediately afterwards. She said, that was me, obviously. No doubt at all, that was me. But I looked up. That wasn't my mum. It was somebody else. And this girl was really, really concerned because she started to doubt who was her mother. And she came and said, look, I don't know, I may have been adopted. Maybe my mother never told me. Because that happens a lot of time if you're... You know, something happens in life, especially in, okay, don't mind saying, she's Chinese. You know, sometimes that if you come from a good family, and or a bad family sometimes, or not so much, too many children, sometimes you give them to an aunt or someone to look after, you know, to actually actually be your surrogate mum. And when she told me that, she was really, really concerned. I said, well, look, you know, it's a waste of time now. It's about 3 or 4 days until the retreat's over. But once the retreat is over, go and see your mum and ask her. Which she did. And she told me what happened. She went up to her mum and said, Mum, you know, just, it's a really tough thing to ask, but, you know, are you really my mum? Imagine doing that. You know, she had the nerve and guts to do that. And her mother, what do you mean? I am your mother. I gave birth to you. I was there at the time. Why on earth are you telling me that? And that's when she told about the experience in deep meditation. And her mother was dumbstruck. So what did that woman look like? And her daughter described this woman in detail, because you've got very clear memory of these powerful experiences. When your mind is very super mindful, you can remember details so clearly. And that's why, you know, just even my baby's pram, I could tell you all about it. I can remember it right now, because these powerful experiences stay with you. So, she described this woman, and her mother was just, wow, that's incredible. That was your wet nurse. You know, the description was enough for her mother to recognize exactly who that was. You know, when, you know, I came from a wealthy family, you know, when you were born, you know, instead of me breastfeeding you, we hired a wet nurse for you. And only for a few weeks. I don't know how the heck you can remember that in such clear detail. And that just convinced this lady of the power of these meditations. But then, go into your last life, one before this. Earlier, please. Now, at this point, I have to give you a warning. You know, because, you know, I love people to do this, but be careful, because so often, not so often, a couple of times, when people have done this, they have got into the most powerful memory from their previous life and the most recent, their death. And like, and most times, death is unpleasant. Once you got past the death moment, it's fine. It is a process, you know, from the last few moments of the life until you actually die. It's often uncomfortable, painful. And a few people did this and they came to complain afterwards, Ajahn Brahm, don't ever let me do that again. And please don't tell other people to do that, because it was the most terrible experience, you know, in a meditation retreat. Imagine, you know, you're not remembering it, you're re-experiencing it, what it's like. And that's very, very, you know, unpleasant. But that's the warning. The solution is, if you do get an unpleasant memory in this sort of way of remembering your past lives, all you need to do is say, earlier, please. And then the mind is just so well trained in this state. As the Buddha said, it's malleable, workable. You know, you can, whatever you tell it to do, it will do it straight away without any hesitation. You just say, earlier, please, and you go back from that unpleasant memory, you know, to a more comfortable memory, you know, of your previous life. So that's a little warning. That's the solution. If ever that happens to you, just say, earlier, please. And then you get back into your previous life. And it's really important, because you know that was actually you. You know, and you, the other thing with it, you know, you can just move around And please remember, because I'm telling you this, now you will do it. It is brainwashing, I admit this. Now I'm giving the suggestion into your mind. I am programming your mindfulness now. If you do get a memory of a previous life, ask yourself, what's my name? What's the year? What's the location? Because what I want you to do is, as for you, you know, you'd be quite clear that that is you. But I want you to actually to prove it for yourself by getting details. And you know, that these days, there's, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, in many places they have records. And you can actually check out whether that really was you. Whether a person of that name, that place actually existed. And actually when you do that, you go into some library somewhere and you look at that year in that place and you see your name in it. The name you remember. And yeah, that's it. There's no doubt anymore that rebirth is a fact. You've got the first cracking of the egg, according to the sutras. You understand, rebirth is a fact. And that changes much of the way you live your life. Many of the things, simple things, I can't understand why people get so upset when people died. Now even, you know, with respect to Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, people were queuing for 8 hours to pay the respects for him. That's not paying respects. No, that is just some sort of weird worship. The best way to pay respects to a person, like what the Buddha said, the best way to pay respects to a Buddha is not with flowers and incense and bowing. This is what the Buddha said. He said the best way to pay respects to the Buddha is to practice what he taught. And that's another reason why I was really inspired by Buddhism. Not the rituals, but what did the Buddha say for you to do? Meditate, keep precepts, be kind, be generous. That's what the Buddha said. He said, that's how you respect a Buddha. That's why I say, if you respect me, you don't respect me by having a really big funeral and everyone crying and sending condolence letters or whatever. Oh, come on. That's why I ask you to do what I ask you to do. Tell bad jokes. Or whatever. But anyway, once you start to experience these previous lives, it also actually starts to put all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle in place. You start to understand things. Now, if that doesn't work, that's actually the best way to do it, I must admit, in meditation. People do these shortcuts now with regression. You know, you go get hypnotized. It's a similar thing in a sense of what you're doing in hypnosis. That you are letting go. You're allowing somebody else to give those orders, but you are totally being submissive, letting go, relaxing. Especially the relaxing bit. I remember talking to, now Dennis, he's into this these days, doing regression therapy, Dennis Shepherd. And no, it's nice having conversations with him. You know, he also does the marriage celebration, so spent a lot of time with him doing these marriages. And you know, sometimes we get there early and just talk about all sorts of things, and that's one of the subjects we always like talking about. And one of the things he was saying is just how he hypnotizes people to get them in, you know, to these deep states is really relaxing the body, first of all. And that maybe, I'm not quite sure, and maybe I know this, but maybe that's one of the reasons I ask you to really relax your body before you meditate. If you've got tension and tightness in the body, you can't really be hypnotized, nor can you get into deep meditation. Hypnotism, meditation, you're accessing your mind rather than the brain. You know, the five senses are being subdued and he's relaxing you, talking you very slowly, very softly. And because he's doing the talking, you're not thinking, you're just listening to the therapist and you're getting into the present moment. And then he just leads you into these ways of accessing, not your brain, but, you know, the mind and what happens in the past. And he tells some really interesting anecdotes. And he's going to tell some more at this conference we're going to. But one of the, anecdotes he loves telling was of this, and it shows you just what I mean about when you access past life, everything tends to understand, you understand what's going on. And understanding karma and attractions and, you know, why you are with the person you are with today. Why you married her, why you married him, you know, your kids, why they came into your life. But anyway, this case, there was a young 16-year-old girl who had anorexia. I often actually say, because I looked up once in a dictionary what anorexia meant. And it says that you can look into a mirror and you think you're fat. And I thought, wow, that's me. I'm anorexic. That's what it says. You know, you look in the mirror, you think you're overweight. But no, this was that real anorexia. You know, she was really thin. Every time she'd eat something, she'd vomit it out. And doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists weren't able to help her at all. She was dying. And the last throw of the dice, they went to the weird stuff, which, you know, the mother thought was these regressionists. But who knows, you know, do anything to save your daughter. And she was easy to hypnotize, and so she got into a past life, this little 16-year-old anorexic. And it became quite clear that why she was doing this to her body. Because in her previous life, so she said, she was the younger of two sisters, and her older sister and her fell in love with the same boy. They just totally head over heels in love with this guy. And she happened to be what she called plain. And her older sister was attractive, was beautiful. Boys being boys, the boy chose the elder sister. And she was so heartbroken when they got married that she committed suicide. She could not stand the fact that she could not have that man. And it was because that she was not attractive. And not being attractive had caused her so much pain to the point of killing herself that in this current life, she was really going over top trying to be attractive by being excessively thin. That was the cause of her anorexia. The pain which she'd experienced not being attractive meant that she was going totally the opposite to be attractive. And the interesting part of this story was that, you know, the mother had to be there, you know, while the therapist was doing this to her daughter, you know, just basically to protect from any abuse. But it was the mother who was hysterical. And this poor therapist, you know, was just taking this young daughter out of hypnosis and now having to deal with this hysterical, moaning, screaming mother. And when he calmed her down, what's going on? Why are you going just bananas, ballistic like this? And that's when the mother said, I was that sister. And when she's told me all of this, this is what happened. I had a younger sister. It was her, my daughter. And in that life, I was attractive. She was ugly. We fell in love with the same guy, my husband, her father. I married her, and then she committed suicide. I never told her. You know, it's one of those things in the family we just don't talk about. So this young girl could not marry that man, so came back as his daughter. Now that is typical what you might read in the sutras and in the Jatakas. And this is real. This is how karma and rebirth, it all sort of comes together. So when you understand these things, wow, you're actually getting the Google view of many lives, karma, and how it all fits together. The attractions. Why are you married the one you married this time? It's not the first time. You pull each other together. Why you meet? It just happens. Something which you can't really know just pulls you together. Here we go again. Understanding this, again, changes your whole view in life. That's why it is a psychic power, and it's a really great one to actually to penetrate. So if you do get into some nice meditations, give it a try, see what happens. What's my earliest memory? If your mind is ready, it will happen immediately. If it doesn't happen within the first second or two, it means, you know, you weren't ready for it, so just forget it. And this is not what you hear, this is what you experience, and it does change your whole life. And if I don't stop now, you'll be reincarnated before I finish, because I've gone on too long. So thank you all for listening. Psychic powers, reincarnations, da 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 da. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. I haven't given that talk before, so a new one.